So, hey there, everyone. My name is Jorvos, and I participate and co-organize a group on Aristotle's Organon. After last year's meetings, I was able to publish my commentary and notes on Aristotle's categories as a book.
Okay, my first question is possibly interesting or obnoxious. I don't know why. I'm curious, what led you and the group that were studying Aristotle to focus on the Organon instead of, say, all the more popular things, the politics, the poetics, the ethics? Why the categories?
The main reason is because we had already read the ethics and
Okay.
the politics and the poetics and
Oh.
the rhetorics and so on. And all the same, we always felt that we were missing on something. And that was how Aristotle himself thought. Like the language he used appear like the words he used appear very normal to us. They are part of our everyday language to a certain extent. Like when we say power or potential and so on, we say it in a very casual way.
So when we
When
see
we
that in the translation, the thing has been translated to power, and you're like, oh, I understand what power is. That word makes sense to me.
Exactly.
Okay.
But what does it mean to Aristotle? And this includes a lot of diving in ancient Greek, a kind of archaeology. And that's where I become very useful for the rest of the group because I'm the only Greek guy who consistently appears there.
You're the closest, the very closest to the ancient Greek than anybody else in the group.
Yeah, we
Yeah.
can say that.
What, so I find exhausting, so that, so I study some Hebrew, which is I learned enough Hebrew to know some words, to be able to speak a tiny bit of modern, to be able to read the prayers and make sense of them in translation. But one of the things that jumps out about the ancient Hebrew is just as you've said, possibly about the ancient Greek, this word can be translated as power. But for those using the word through the century and the millennia, that word may have many different, it's like a web. Every word is like a web into other meanings that my English understanding of that word is closer to all the ways it is. I don't understand that web, but you see a word. It says this translated into your language, and you think, I know what that web is. I find it exhausting what you're talking about, where we're going to delve into what do these words mean to Aristotle, because it's not just a one-to-one. It's not like once you establish that this word means quote unquote power, really it's a web of meaning attached to other words and other ideas that we don't have to that word. I find that exhausting. How did you not become immediately exhausted by the months of doing this?
Because I habituated myself, that's one of the good things about the Nicomachean Ethics. It's that it teaches us the power of habits.
Okay.
And it's not done in a modern context where they also want to tell you which habits are valuable. It's done in a freer context because I am unattached from the world of Aristotle. So when he gives me advice about how I should be, I can look at it from an outside observer point of view and say, well, in his world, he liked that. And then I can say, what's the meta message that I can derive? And that's habits. And then in the same way that we all, and I'm not saying it in any judgmental way, we all in the Western world habituate ourselves to overfeed ourselves, and we somehow all together can't really get a proper grasp of proper nutrition. Like even the ones who do it, That's the same way I habituated myself in looking with excitement for all these words without getting bored.
Wait, so you gave, so it's interesting, you gave the example because you used the example of nutrition, so maybe that's a good one or a bad one. There are some people who are excited about the micro and macro aspects of nutrition, but for many of the people who, for instance, I need to know what these words mean, they would not be excited at all by the habituated pattern of studying these words or the habituated pattern of studying what all these foods do, what their impacts are on my body, what the science says about this. So is there something about you and the way you like to slowly work through books or pull them slowly apart? Is that just an aspect of your own personality? Or again, you attribute that, no, I'm not like that, but I picked up this habit from Aristotle.
Well, the fundamental thing about this is that once I pick up a habit, it becomes part of myself. So that it started as something external, of course, like most things that become our habits probably start because of some external locus. There's always some kind of potential that we show. And of course, I showed some potential towards language and linguistics and so on as a young person, but that I came across these ideas and then I somehow ended up doing this. Yeah, it does also have something to do with me, and it does also have something to do with what I surrounded myself with.
Can I ask, so again, thinking about the habitual, regular study of this work until you work your way to the end. So that's, again, having not read the entire thing, but read the beginning and the ending of it and skimmed through the rest of it. This study, this commentary is exhaustive about working its way line by line, part by part, through the thinking about things. Kind of a real, deep, slow, personal encounter with the work. Why was that attractive versus, I think many people, if they want to understand Aristotle's politics, they might slowly work their way through the politics, or they might just be like, I'm going to read some stuff online, or I'm going to read a book about Aristotle's Organon, and that'll tell me from an expert what the Organon says. What about the personal slow encounter with the book was different than what you could have gained from secondary sources?
Well, that's the thing. Like the personal encounter, I found it to be something that it was an ancient or a traditional kind of hobby, let's say, or passion to go or it was actually a standard part of education at some point to go through these primary texts and come up with your own conclusions. And, you know, we have one commentary which is very famous by Thomas Aquinas. But before it and after it, there are thousands of commentaries which were written by thousands of people. Most of them are lost, forgotten, not that important because they just rehash something someone else said. Right. They have different utilities. For example, there are some commentaries which were written by teachers who wanted to teach this to their students. And there were commentaries which had a kind of political orientation and they wanted to push some kind of point about, hey, you know, like we have to deal with this in this way. And so each person had a purpose behind writing it. And in this case, my purpose was basically to understand at a deeper level what not only what Aristotle says with the words he uses, but also most philosophers. Because after Aristotle, like the wording and concepts were inherited to other major philosophers, continental or analytic, or of any other, I don't know how to call it, category or denomination or whatever.
Yeah.
And so they're important words. And just by going through the categories, I then went, I just read through a book I had read several years ago. And I could immediately see all the terms like the relative, the quality, etc. And then see that, like, put more emphasis in them, as opposed to a person who looks at the word and says, oh, I know what that word means, but they can't really properly contextualize it or put it in the right framework.
It reminds me a bit of the practice that happens at some of the liberal arts colleges in the last 100 years or 150 years in America that are modeled after Europe, but they will have famously St. John's College, which I think has a couple campuses. They famously have their kids in their first and second years studying not modern science, but reading Aristotle and Bacon and older scientists who wrote these things hundreds of years ago, to pore over basically studies, even long studies of things that have been debunked that are not true, but they're asking them to read scientists and philosophers who may not have been right about their facts, but to reason their way through their arguments to understand their thinking, as opposed to, well, now I know what this word means, I'm done. This sounds like more an exercise, and you have to sit in the person's thinking. How did they process these things, even if their end result was wrong?
Yes, and I think that's wonderful, especially because we have a very universalized idea about knowledge and logic. We think that logic is something that exists.
Right.
And then we think that we can freely access it. Instead, we should situate, as you suggested, that it is the practice of that school. We should be able to situate ourselves in different logical systems and then see how they work, and especially one which we have already determined is flawed. We'll even shine some light on things that we may on flaws that we may, or like mistakes that we may commit in the future as we reason through our own experiments or understanding of the world. I think that a good way to think about this is the idea of the world as a map. Like we have the world, and inside of us, we try to understand our surroundings. We are surrounded by different people, trees, things, etc. We try to understand where we are, who we are, where we are, what everything around us is. And especially as children, this activity is very high. And as we do it, we kind of create a map in our brain of how the world works. And, well, what happens? At first, we create a very primitive rough map. And then with time, we refine different parts of it, which are relevant to us. Unfortunately, we cannot get the whole world inside here.
Right.
But we try. And the more accurate the map is, the more successful we will be with our dealings in the world. It's kind of like fire. Like as a child, we had a fireplace. I would see it at different distances, and that would give me an idea of what's the comfortable distance to see it. What's the distance that keeps me warm, but doesn't get me too warm or too cold or even burn me. And Everything had been tried. I even burned myself once.
Just to fully test to see how close is really too close.
Yes, and I wasn't testing with some kind of scientific rigor. I was just a child playing around.
Okay, I have, again, I could see taking this even bigger picture. So I like that idea of maps. So now if you can think, I want to get more specific. So having completed the entire run through your commentary, through the text, can you give an example of something you learned about Aristotle or about the categories or about the comparing an ancient version of the world to a modern version of the world? So something, a specific example of something before you read the categories and after you read it, you understand something much better.
I think that the part which I felt the most benefited from was chapter 7, where he was discussing relatives.
Okay.
And what do I mean with relatives? Well, it's kind of like this. We have certain titles, and the titles or word, like these words, they mean something. Now, part of the meaning is contingent on, let's say, another word, and I'm going to give an example in a bit, which points to some other aspect of it. And if we don't have the one, then we don't have the other. So, for example, I can go and say, I'm a teacher. And of course, it means something. But do I have any students? At the moment, I don't. And so we can then say, okay, so you are not a practicing teacher, let's say. Do you have some kind of education? Yes, then you can say, okay, so you have received the education to be a teacher. And that's why you say you are a teacher. So there's a kind of like, it's not just that I can go and give myself this title. Like, what stands behind it? And so there's this teacher student. And yes?
How do you keep in that case, if what we're doing is asking teacher, what does teacher mean? There's also a risk of kind of this infinite, I don't know what to call it, an infinite regress or an infinite progression, or you can infinitely keep slicing a word. Does Aristotle seem to struggle with, find it interesting? How does Aristotle manage where the question ends? So if we want to determine what does teacher mean, so the category of teacher, someone is a teacher, let's ask some questions about that, but you could ask 3 questions about that, 10 questions about that, 1,000 questions about that. Does it deal at all with the category's usefulness in the world?
Well, what he does is say that there's a relative and a correlative.
Okay.
And then, of course, you point the danger out that maybe we can find 10 or 10,000 different ways that a particular title correlates with that. Aristotle in the categories is just trying to expand on the basics of the relative. So he's probably going to come back to it later, but at the same time, I felt that it was already valuable that he introduced this concept, because we always say, like, we can say he's a relativist or everything's relative or things like that.
Right.
Which on a certain level are inane platitudes, but we can also go with, like, as you suggested, a more rigorous way and then say, okay, so this word is a relative. What is it relative to? And then we can write down what it is relative to, and then we can pursue that.
Is is the relative is the opposite of the relative, or the value at the other side of the tension. What's the opposite of relative? Is it absolute, where this is what the thing is, this is what the word means, this is its quote unquote nature, versus what we can say about it? What's the opposite of relative? If things are relative, when people talk about relativism and they're talking about it negatively, they're saying, well, you just say there's no truth and everything is just context. What's happening in the moment? You know, you have some other values you're applying to it, versus it is a thing. It has nature. It is the thing, a teacher. It, by its very nature, it's a teacher. Is that the opposite of relative, or is something else the opposite?
Well, when we follow the content of what Aristotle presents, what we have is the relation which can be portrayed as an opposition of relative and correlative.
Correlative. Okay, what's the difference?
They are both relatives. And the difference is that, like, one, it, like, there's no real difference outside from how it is used in a sentence. So if I say that, I don't know, Mr. Harrison is my teacher.
Okay.
That means that correlatively, I am his student. If I say that I'm the student of Mr. Harrison, that means that correlatively, he's my teacher.
Okay.
So there's this interplay between the two. And of course, Aristotle doesn't use teacher and student. That's for our age. He keeps using master and slave.
Okay. I understand your shift from master and slave. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. At the same time, he recognizes other, let's say, forms of relatives, or ways words can be relatives. And there's, for example, relatives that have to do with quantity. Mm-hmm. Like, we say that something is small. Like, if I say that this mug that I'm holding right now is small, then what am I falling back on? There must be some kind of concept, some kind of universal in my head about, like, a general idea about mugs, that they should be this huge.
Right.
And
right.
And then this is small. Yeah. But if I come from, a Middle Eastern country where they all have very small cups where they drink their coffee, then that is a big coffee vessel.
Okay, I'm seeing a co-relativity, correlating, is when a thing is a thing because another thing has a relationship to it. And is relativity, you're looking at a thing, there's still some spectrum or idea, but is this more of the mind now, where I'm thinking I have an idea of what good and bad means? I have an idea of what something being bright and something being dark is, and I'm comparing it to that. But this thing could be dark without necessarily being in a relationship with another thing that connects it.
Yeah, exactly. Because okay. when we go to the substances, let's say, there are the prime substances, which are the things in the world, like this plant is a substance, this image is a substance, etc. And then we have the secondary substances, which are a bit more abstract. And this means that, like, when I say that a particular man is a man, then I'm taking a particular and attributing a universal to it. Now, he doesn't use these terms in the categories, but I think that these terms that I'm using make it more understandable.
Okay.
So those are two ways. Now, with regards to the absolute, he doesn't try to find a way that teacher is an absolute. And he just stays within the topic of the relatives, and he tries to explain what he means. He goes through a bunch of other stuff. Another interesting one is knowledge, like a knowledge of something, and then knowable. So the idea is that in order for me to have knowledge of something, this something must be knowable. I must be able to access it in this way. And then he says, well, there are knowables in the world. And then when we get to know them, then we have knowledge of them.
Right.
But that doesn't mean that just because something is knowable, that we already have knowledge of it. And it's probably like kangaroos in the time of Aristotle. I'm sure that there were kangaroos in Australia back then. It wasn't even called Australia, but no one knew about them. Or potatoes.
They were knowable, but we did not have knowledge of them. Yeah.
Yeah, so he makes these distinctions. And so the knowledge of something is relative to the knowability, to its knowability.
Do you find, I think if I had to guess why people read the politics, the poetics, the ethics, and the writing on rhetoric more often than the work on categories, it's because those, as you said, it's interesting. You said, I can read Aristotle from a distance and not take it personally or not think that Aristotle is telling me how to live my life. I'm trying to figure out how Aristotle thought and work my way through Aristotle's thinking. Those other things are people looking for things Aristotle will tell me about how my political system should work, about how I should think about art, about how I should speak to others and ask how others are speaking to me with the rhetoric. Is the reason the categories get shoved aside because it doesn't promise to tell us how we should morally live our lives in some way in society or in our personal lives?
Well, you bring up a very interesting point, and I think that the answer, like, it appears to me very to be a very straightforward answer. We look for what we lack.
We look for what we lack.
So in this world, we are very convinced that we are logical beings and that we adhere to rigorous scientific principles. And it's kind of like everywhere I turn, there will be some YouTube video where they will have like EMC square or something like that.
Yeah.
As though I don't understand it. I see it. I have seen it often enough. I don't know what it means. Okay, of course, someone will tell me, well, EMC squared equals mass, blah, blah. Okay. Yeah. Thank you very much. Like there must be like some kind of situating activity which contextualizes it. But, and there can be that, like I could like follow a lesson, but in order to put, let's say, a plant into a pot, like you have to have the pot. Like if there is no pot in my mind to put that plant, then it's not going to go anywhere. Like it's kind of like dropping seeds around. Like if I don't put some kind of fertile soil for those seeds to grow, then it won't work.
So the problem is that people are convinced. They look at the world and they think about their relationship to art and think, well, surely, well, I don't know everything there is to know about art. I could understand better art. I could understand better politics. But are you saying there is a lack of humility on our part where we do not understand how badly or how little we know about logic? Everyone thinks I can reason. I can think things through. So that must mean I'm good at thinking things through because I can see myself thinking things through. I think that's bad for these reasons. I'm a good thinker. And so maybe people don't spend as much time on interrogating or questioning their ability to think and reason.
I agree with you, and I can talk about this in this way.
Okay.
So we receive a constant input of a constant linguistic input of information. Some of this information at the point where we receive it appears interesting to us, and in this way, we're more able to hold on to it. Once we hear it repeated to us enough times, once we put the, let's say, the intellectual labor to learn it, to map it out, and write that exam, and ace it, or even have a passing grade, we then take this piece of knowledge and appropriate it for us. But still, even when we put the intellectual labor for that, we put intellectual labor to understanding someone else's intellectual labor. Now, there's this idea which comes up in a book by Heidegger. He keeps saying, I'm looking at a tree. I'm looking at a tree. And then when I was reading it, I was like, is he crazy? Like he kept repeating it. I'm looking at a tree. And the idea is like this confrontation with the world without language. I think that last time when I mentioned this, you talked about the DAO, but it's not, I thought about it. It's not exactly that. It's more like, what if I go in the world without like emptying myself of language,
right?
But then instead of avoiding language, instead I try to rearticulate things from the beginning. Like, of course, the first reaction is, why invent the wheel another time?
Yes, that is my first devil's advocate argument. Why make your cleanse your mind and re-encounter all these things you've already assimilated?
Because at that point, you are left with your senses, with your ability to perceive things. And then you can have this encounter. It will be something more real. Like, I remember when I was tackling these questions for myself before I started reading the categories, I would go for a walk and start touching different trees. Like, it sounds inappropriate. It's actually very fun. Like, I would just like find an oak tree and I'll be like, how does the oak tree smell? How does it feel to put my hands against the oak tree and push? How does it feel to like scratch at its bark? Like, all these things we do not have in our everyday discourse. And of course, someone will say, well, everything you're saying right now just sounds weird. Yes, it is weird. It is weird to us because we have developed like this inane bubbles where we encapsulate everything. And then like I just look at trees and I go, trees, trees. And then all the time, so many hours of our days, click, click, tap, tap, click, click, tap, tap. Like, I think that that's weirder. How much time do we spend clicking and tapping? Like, let's use our senses in some kind of different way. Another thing I was doing was like trying to learn how to balance. I bought a balance board just to see how it is. So, yes.
To feel what it's like to, so you, your normal heuristic, your normal habit would be, when I was a little kid, I learned how to walk. I don't have to balance. I know how to balance. I know it when I wake up every morning, I'm able to walk without falling over. I don't have to ask about balance. And you're saying, well, what is balance? What would it be like to feel imbalanced? Do I understand all, when you stand on that balance ball, I know exactly what you're talking about. When I stand on this firm ground, I don't question anything. It's the firm ground. That's a tree. I can stand on the ground, but stand on the balance ball and you can feel the muscles from your neck all the way down to your ankles. moving and shifting. All of a sudden you can feel the little micro movements that have to happen for you not to fall over.
Yes. And this level of engagement is more real for us humans. Mm. And this also brings, let's say, more passion in us when we talk about these things. So if I ask like Mr. Encyclopedia, ChatGPT or something to talk to me about oaks, he can regurgitate like so much information about it, and still there lacks this feeling of like he gets it, he understands it. I mean, he can even train his rhetorical dispositions and say it like in a very, you know, like, well, the oak tree is deciduous, and like, or something like that. But
and it still comes from here, and this is how it grows, and this is how you care for it, blah, 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 blah.
And then you have someone who works in the, like, as a forest guard, and he's trying to get more oak trees in the forest. And he's out there in the forest every day. He's looking at all these seedlings sprouting out of the ground. He's clearing up other plants which might threaten the poor seedling, etc. And he knows that the squirrel has done his job once again, forgot all those nuts in the ground. And he has something, a more real experience. And then when he talks about it, it's like, well, you know, the oak trees, well, so many accidents by squirrels.
Okay, then I'll just play devil's advocate the whole time, because in some ways I think philosophy, religion, art, a lot of these things are people having these experiences you're talking about, a more real experience, a divine intervention, an intense emotional experience with a work of art. They're having some feeling, experience with the world, with their senses and their whole body. But people will look out at the world and say, as you started at the very beginning, you said, how do you study these books? I don't like studying these books this way. And you're like, well, I started with a habit. People could argue all these things you're talking about, the fact that I don't think about balance all day, people are like, yeah, you're not supposed to. You're not supposed to look at every tree and experience that tree mindfully. You're using the cheat codes. You're using the shortcuts. Language is just a shortcut. Don't think about this. Move on. Don't think about this. Move on. Because we need to get through this. We can get through this faster if the one guy has the passionate experience in the forest, writes a book about how to care for oaks, and then now we all know how to care for oaks. Now I need to think about it. So what's being lost if more things are shortcutted like that? Because I think language, it's just our little brain seeking survival shortcuts. Why not take the survival shortcuts?
Well, I say take the survival shortcuts. It's just that, okay, so we have, once again, like this archive of knowledge.
Okay.
It's there. So the forest guy wrote a book, How to Take Care of Oak Trees.
Yeah.
Now, I can just read it out of general interest about the welfare of oak trees, and I'm not going to gain much out of the read. But if I'm really into the preservation of oak trees, then I'll go there myself and have the hands-on experience. And then the things that are said there will make sense, will make more sense, will make sense in a more fundamental level, and will make much more sense as the person reads and rereads what is being said.
But there's so much stuff, and it's just easier or entertaining to just let all the music and the things outside and the food and the TV and the books and the people's conversations, just let it wash over you and just grab things that are entertaining in the moment. What's this whole thing about making life more real? I understand that can be a goal. Is that like, what does it mean more real? Does that mean you spend more time on something, you get bored with it? Wouldn't you rather cycle through things faster and just get new things faster? I'm just arguing all the devil's advocate positions.
Yeah, of course. Well, the way you say it, you invite, you like, you give me the place to say, well, it's all about quality over quantity. And I mean, now we're going back to the Nicomachean Ethics, where he said like there are three kinds of attitudes towards the world. And of course, there are no clear categories. People are in between different categories. They jump through them, etc. But at the end of the day, what we encounter every day is the world. And people who encounter the same every day, that's why they are bored. So they should open up to more things which sound inane, like and then see if they can find something in them that is attractive to them. And of course, we have to start thinking about and that actually goes a bit back to Plato's Gorgias, about what the real things are and what the kind of like fake substitutes are. So as a human, what am I really seeking? What would put me in a condition where I'm prospering? And like take these questions and really try to find the answers. And then out of the blue, things will start appearing as either the real thing or the substitute. And how do we test? Well, the test is that the substitute gives you like a few seconds of, let's say, you relax for a few seconds. You feel that you finally have it. And then by the end, the minute arrives after you've done the substitute thing, you are already feeling, in quotation marks, miserable again.
Very temporal, very, very temporary.
Yeah. Yes. But at the same time, it has taken some of your energy away. You feel exhausted. And once you regain that energy, maybe you will go again for that experience. But the, let's say in quotation marks, the real thing, as opposed to in quotation marks, a substitute, like you will have a kind of stability in yourself, and you won't have to worry about chasing some momentary feeling. Like it will just be there. Maybe I'm not explaining it very well, but you know.
Oh no, you're explaining it perfectly. I would just like to say, this is the kind of talk that at the very highest level, people who are encouraging others to undertake massive spiritual quests or to really dig deep into their personal exploration, or encouraging people to join their religion. So I feel like this message of what you're talking about is the promise that gets touted by many thinkers throughout history, that there's a more real, more substantive, more stable, more powerful experience you could be having, and that here's how you parse this one way or the other. Some of them tell you exactly what to do. Here are the 5 habits you have to do. Here are the 7 things you need to do every morning. Here are the 9 things you have to do at night. Here's the one thing you have to do this year to fix yourself. Again, as you said, sense of your lack. How come you saying these things are not motivated and called? Don't you want to go be like a self-help guru and just like pitch people on like the authentic experience they're missing in life and like sell books and like do webinars and stuff?
I'm not really good at marketing.
This is my perennial. I hate marketing. I'm just not good at it. I hate it. I don't like it. Yeah.
And I can't maintain like this kind of posturing for a long time.
Yeah.
And actually, there was a time in my life a few years ago where I was like, for the entire year, I was running study groups on Plato and a bit on Aristotle with a bunch of people, and I wasn't even getting the credit for it. But I was so happy that I was just doing it.
Okay.
I was so happy that I was just doing it that I didn't care about the credit. I just wanted to do it. And then after I did it for a while, I kind of no longer found it, let's say, pleasurable to have to spend so much time, and that's counterintuitive to a self-help guru or a tutor, to have to spend so much time explaining the same things. Of course, it's good to do that. Of course, repetition and being a good teacher helps the person learn things with stability. But I wanted to move further. I didn't want to repeat the same things over and over again. I just wanted to make the breakthrough. So when I started this group with another person, like this time I wanted it to be with people who were, let's say, intellectually peers. And in the preface of the book I wrote, I also kind of shared the experience of how it is, because it's not easy at all. When it was kind of top down in previous iterations, someone would say something and I would tell them, good job, or you missed this point, this point, this point. And it was top down.
Right.
So at all times, like I already knew what points had to be covered, and I just had to point them to the person. And if they checked them, I would say, I would okay it. But this time, I have to deal with people who can see through holes in my thinking, or who can see something that I'm missing. And
right.
then if I go with the attitude of, well, that's okay, and you missed that point, that, of course, I can do it. But I expect to be compensated, and I don't mean with money. I expect that person to, like, in the next turn, he will tell me, you missed that point. How about this sentence? How do you interpret that?
So if not money, at the least you're asking, hey, if I'm going to teach a class of students, eventually these students need to equal or surpass me. I'm demanding either monetary remuneration, or I'm going to get an intellectual thing, because you're going to hit me and surpass me.
No, because they're not my students. We're already on a plane level.
Oh no, I'm just saying your previous thing. If those people had shot upward and eventually they'd been, oh, now you're with me and now we can journey together. But it was people who, again, they're starting their journey all the time, over and over and over, and nobody's really joining you on your path.
Like they were, I was situating them in a specific philosophical context.
Right.
And with time, some people had stuck. They stuck for the entire year. But at the end of it, it always felt like I was, when they reached a certain level, they would be like, okay, I'm going to give a bit of my time to you, but then I also want to read that book. And they wouldn't read it with me. They would read it by themselves.
Okay.
And in the meantime, they would be replaced by other people who are like, Plato? Who's Plato?
Okay, so you did not want to teach Platonic philosophy one-on-one every year for the rest of your life.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
And so this group is a very welcome challenge for me. Like the two main interlocutors I have are Tony and Tom. Tom is also my co-organizer. It's kind of fun because we each have our roles. And the one questions a lot. And like he's like, well, George. So okay, you just read this paragraph of your notes, but like, could you just please rephrase it for me? Like, could you just please take me along? And I'm like, okay, so I'm saying this, this, and this. And then he just like, well, and then he plays Socrates. He's like, well, I'm just trying to be very humble. And I don't want to be seduced by what you say here. So could you tell me why you think that's important? So I have to explain these things. And he doesn't ask it just because he feels like asking a bunch of questions. He asks it because he's genuinely interested.
Right. So that this leads me to maybe my final question, which is you undertook this study experience on this book and you liked it so much. You're like, I'm going to do this output of this commentary. So you've done the commentary on the categories. What's your next step? Are you going to reread it or are you moving on to another thing?
Now we are already on interpretation because we plan to do the whole of the Organon.
Okay.
The reason why I made the book was actually because I wanted to give the group some kind of anchor of achievement. Like, we finished the categories. And the price I put on it was symbolic. Of course, I had to pay the artist, so I thought that maybe if enough people buy it, then I can get the money for the artist back. And even, okay, like, in my wildest imaginations, I could even hire him to do more art for me. So it doesn't matter. I did it for the group, and my main purpose and goal is to allow for the group to grow, to find more people who would be interested in joining and undertaking this experience and learning, because like, the one main benefit is that it strengthens a person's thinking, and it makes all other philosophy books more intelligible. And so, yeah, that's it. And now, like, the thing I have just started,
yes,
is because I think that after a certain update, Reddit numbers have thinned down. I don't get as much interaction as I used to. I started a Substack. I don't know if that's a good move, but I'm going to put all my notes on non-interpretation there for free. And anyone who just wants to read the notes is free to just subscribe, and even not subscribe, just go there, visit, and look at the notes I'll be posting weekly, which will cover the whole of On Interpretation by Aristotle. And if someone reads them and thinks, oh, that's interesting, maybe I would like some more, then they can join us every Tuesday. I think it's 2:30 p.m. Eastern Time. It's 8:30 p.m. Central European Time. And that person, he or she, they can just listen to us, or they can join in and participate. Eventually, maybe they'll become an active member. We have been already doing this for more than 2 years. It started with only two, me and Tom. Mm-hmm. I remember at some point we said we'll do Aristotle together, and there's this professor Leo Strauss who, yep, was in the University of Chicago, and we found his transcript where he taught the Nicomachean Ethics at a college, Claremont College, and we read through the entire lecture transcript together. And then we came up together with the idea of creating a group for the Organon. And at that point, we managed to get a few people on board. We have 5 regulars. But of course, we have many people who just come and listen. Right. And if anyone would like to join us, well, you feel free to.